Anyway, good morning. Welcome to Free for All Friday. In the studio, we have Dr. John Patrick, and we're going to talk about healthcare and what should we do? What should the next president do to fix the healthcare problems? We're going to have all that right within this hour, right, John?
That's right.
Okay. Bill Toll with us here also with the Florida Hospital Flagler Foundation, or what's your title now? You move around in there.
Well, I'm actually the director of the Florida Hospital Hospice Care Foundation. We have two foundations. John Subers is the overall chief, and I work specifically, more specifically with the Hospice Care Foundation.
Okay. And Brian McMillan, our co-host and with the editor of the Palm Coast Observer, should be joining us at any time here. All right. Well, here, let's get right into it with the healthcare. A very ranks right up there with everybody, with the presidential elections, and everybody's got something, you know, to say. And, you know, what's wrong? Here, let's start with this. What's wrong with Obamacare? Everybody in the country now has it. If you're poor, you get it for free. And if you're rich, well, you just pay a little bit more so everybody else can have it for free. Isn't that the perfect scenario? Dr. John Patrick.
Well, it's not quite that simple. The biggest problem in our healthcare system is the cost. And while everybody does have some form of healthcare insurance, well, not everybody, but more than ever, the deductibles are so large that even for a family that's paying very little for their insurance, they may have a deductible of $10,000. So their healthcare cost is out of pocket for them, and it's unaffordable.
But a lot of people don't know that until they go to use it.
Well, that's true. So in effect, it's catastrophic insurance. So that part, that's good. But for people that have acute conditions, chronic conditions, it's extremely expensive. And we have no transparency to the prices that we pay. Drug costs are spiraling at outrageous growth rates.
Well, let's talk about cost of prescriptions, all right? Because, you know, I'm kind of torn between the two things. You know, you hear how pharmaceutical companies are ripping everybody off, and, you know, and why does it cost, you know, so much for a particular drug? But to me, somewhere in there has to be the cost of research and how many attempts are made. You know, I mean, these drug companies pay a lot of money to colleges and universities, and kids are working on all these different programs to find cures for us, and maybe one out of 100,000, you know, work. And so, isn't it short-sighted to really blame pharmaceutical companies for charging so much for one pill when, in fact, the business model, they have to stay in business?
They have to stay in business, and without them, we wouldn't be living as long as we live. So they've done wonderful, wonderful things for the world. On the other hand, the prices right now are out of control. And, yes, they have to spend an awful lot for research. It takes a long time. Many of the drugs are not successful. They have to withdraw them. They deserve to make more money than the average company. But how much more is really the question. And the root cause of this cost problem goes back to 2003 when the Bush administration passed, or Congress passed, the Prescription D plan, the Medicare Part D prescription drug plan. And in that legislation in 2003, they inserted a little provision that said Medicare cannot negotiate the price of drugs. This is insane. Every other country in the world negotiates those prices. As a result, Europeans pay half of what we pay for exactly the same medications because of our Congress.
Well, and this is kind of the mantra of Donald Trump, that we don't negotiate. Is that part of what he's saying when we were talking about our own government rules that prohibit them from negotiating?
Well, I think he's talking about, you know, everything's negotiable, but I'm referring very specifically to the cost of drugs, and they should be negotiated. And if more money is needed for research, a good place to start would be to stop the advertising on TV that's $5 billion a year that adds nothing to American healthcare. Questionable even if we want our children watching some of these ads, and do we want people who are growing up and becoming seniors to perceive that the only way they can be happy when they're in their 50s and 60s is if they're taking drugs. The American Medical Association has come out and tried and asked for that to be banned, and we're the only country in the world that allows it. And other countries have great health care. They don't need TV advertising. I don't think we do either.
Don't you think the disclaimer on those ads kind of You know,
people ignore it.
They do?
They do. And you know, the advertisers are very clever. They use a different voice to speak those disclaimers than the voice that tells you how wonderful the drug is. They're very clever at how they speak those disclaimers in a way that is clear, but not so clear. And
soothing female voice.
Yeah, they basically convince people, to not pay any attention.
So it'll improve your sex life, but it might kill you.
It might kill you.
Okay.
Yeah, and toenail fungus, that one's a good one. A little tube, it's $600, has an 18% effectiveness. So we spend, there's a lot of wasted money in that regard.
Well, okay, but they say ask your doctor.
Yeah, and that's why the doctors don't like it. The doctors hate this. They don't want to be the person that has to say no, and so they just cave and say, sure, go ahead.
They don't have time to watch TV, so they don't know what the TV is telling them.
Yeah, exactly right.
Okay. So doctors don't like it when you come in for your problem. You go, hey, have you heard about this new drug called whatever? The doctors just kind of cringe about it.
Exactly. And you know,
how do doctors find out about new drugs? They don't have time to watch TV.
They have websites that they use. They read journal papers. But it's true. They don't have time to understand all these drugs. But consumers are pretty smart. You know, we've learned how to search on the Internet. If we have we have toe fungus or, you know, we know how to search on Google to find what the diagnosis might be, what the various treatment options are. We have very good websites today that can be a resource for people. We don't need to be advertised to.
Okay. Well, and you know, you say, and by the way, if you just tuned in, Dr. John Patrick is our guest here. He's a author. He's a leading healthcare and technology expert and author, which is kind of interesting how the technology and healthcare all come together. Why have you kind of gotten your arms around this?
Well, my background is in technology. I was at IBM for 35 years. And when I retired from IBM 14 years ago, I joined the board of a local teaching community hospital and began to learn a lot about healthcare. And I was appalled at what I saw, how inefficient it is and how little sharing of information there is. I came from a world of, you know, click here and things happen. And in healthcare, I found there's no place to click. So I got interested, went back to school at age 65 and earned a doctorate in health administration and wrote the book Health Attitude.
Well, the political scene right now, let me read this paragraph and then we'll kind of pick this apart as we go, okay? And it says the 2016 political scene is unfolding. Okay, unfolding is a good word. In less than a year, American citizens will decide on our next president and who it's going to be. So far in the debates, town hall speeches, a little substance has been discussed about health care. Despite the fact approaching 20% of our economy and touches every American, and Ken Madison, our CEO here, said that if we hit 25%, it could be that's the threshold of collapse of an economy. Do you agree with that?
It's very possible. It's unaffordable. Every day, 10,000 people turn 65 and join Medicare. So if we keep spending the same amount we're spending today per person, we'll be in big trouble long before 25%, in my opinion.
And you're not being political, really, but you almost have to some way. You hear what else you have you say. You could say the problem in healthcare has been caused by the action by one party and inaction by another party, but you could say Republicans want this and Democrats want that. But you don't think that labeling should be the focus. The problem is Congress and both sides.
Right.
How is that?
Well, the first example we spoke of a moment ago about not allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of drugs.
And that's Congress?
That's Congress. That was a provision inserted into the legislation that said Medicare cannot negotiate the price of drugs.
So the rat we smell are lobbyists?
1,500 lobbyists in the pharmaceutical industry. They spend $200 to $300 billion a year in lobbying activities. So I think it's very fair to say that Congress marches to the tune of the special interest groups. And it's not just pharmaceutical industry, it's many other industries, but the pharma lobby is the largest lobby of any industry.
So all this then comes to people uprising now about the establishment. Because the establishment is who the lobbyists, all of these lobbyists who make a good living and help congressmen who say they're underpaid and can barely pay their bills and all this kind of stuff, so they need supplemental income, so they take it from the lobbyists. It's legal. And so this is what we have.
Well, what we have right now from a political perspective is we have two extremes. We have, on the one hand, an extreme position that says eliminate the health insurance companies and create one even bigger government funded, take care of everybody from Washington, D.C. kind of a program. And then at the other extreme, we have a let's rip up the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Let's just get rid of it and start over again. So neither of those extremes is going to happen. There's zero chance of either of those happening. So we really need some common sense, and that's what my little article was about, is let's address the key problems. Let's address the cost and the fraud and the unnecessary advertising, and let's get accountable care in place, which pays an incentive to providers such as the hospital and all the great and wonderful doctors and nurses we have, but pay them based on our health, not based on our sickness.
But isn't the advertising somewhat of a freedom of speech where they have a product and they want people to be aware of it? And
well, that's the argument, that without this advertising, consumers would not become aware. I don't buy that. People become aware through the internet. And if you look at the other countries in the world, who by the way, their healthcare is better than ours in many countries, it's way less expensive than ours, they don't allow this advertising. And they have the same drugs. They're available throughout Europe to people that really need them. But this advertising is faking us out. You know, it's causing us to ask for drugs that are more expensive than the drugs that can do the job just as well.
All right. So there's the problem. What's the solution?
Well, with regard to advertising, I mean, that's not the biggest problem. It's a problem, and the solution is do what every other country in the world does and just don't allow it. We don't allow everything and anything to be advertised, and that's one of the things that the medical industry, over 200,000 doctors say, you know, we don't need that. But I think the big problem is the overall cost. Drugs is about 15% of it. The major, major cost problem is unnecessary tests and procedures. And we all run into this. You know, blood tests that are done over and over and over again. Sometimes then we go to a specialist. They ask for a test that we just had from another doctor, but it's easier to get another test than to get the data from the test we had a week ago. So those are the core problems we need to address. And the incentive system is designed to pay providers for the more they do, the more they get paid. You know, it's a per click.
Well, you know, and on that, I'm still trying to absorb what Adventist Florida Hospital Flagler is doing, because they've, and Ken Madison explains it better than I can, how the hospital is getting in the risk business. So it right. used to be, and still is, in most places where, all right, yeah, let's put them through all these tests and things because we bought this expensive machine. We got to keep it, you know, using it, and the doctors are incentivized to keep doing all these tests.
Right.
But now, and maybe Bill, you can explain it a little bit better here for Ken, that what we're doing is saying, if you're a kind of a member, in other words, instead of paying the insurance company, you're kind of a member in a way with the local hospital, they have an incentive to keep you healthy and not to be using all the tests and keeping you in there. Can you explain what I'm trying to say a little better, Bill?
Well, what we're trying to do, and I think we're having a degree of success, but just beginning to roll it out, we are not as much in the risk business as we are in the insurance business. And basically, we're becoming self-insured so that people can join our system and actually have coverage that way. One thing, though, that is putting a lot of pressure on our bottom line is the Affordable Care Act and the way people have gone in. People that can afford insurance think they have this great insurance because they have this wonderful low premium, but they have these exorbitant deductibles, copays, and so they say, I have insurance, so they come to our emergency department, and they still can't afford the copay. So we still end up giving away the care. You know, that's really putting pressure on healthcare systems all over the country. Because people don't really realize they don't have insurance in all practical, you know, in a practical sense. What they have is something that will give them some help if they have a catastrophic event, but not so much that little, you know, come to the emergency room for an upper respiratory infection or something.
So is, Obamacare is a big profit, the insurance companies kind of twisted it around where Obamacare is great for them, right?
Yeah, well, that's another special interest group is in fact that industry. But you know, when we talk about Obamacare, there's 10 parts to Obamacare. 10 parts. 10, it's a big, big piece of legislation.
Does Obama know that?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure he does. But, most of the politicians, I would say, don't know. So when they say repeal it, repeal everything, throw the baby out with the bathwater. So there are a lot of problems in Obamacare. There are some things that there are hidden taxes. There are things that don't work right. There's a lot of things that go to the special interest group. So I'm not praising Obamacare, but there are some things in there that are very good. For example, the biggest, most important piece of it, in my opinion, is called Accountable Care. Accountable Care, ACO, Accountable Care Organization. And these are popping up around the country. There's around 1,000 of them now. There will be quite a few thousand of them. And it's basically a contract. A simple example would be Medicare, or it could be Aetna or Blue Cross or another payer. But one of the payers makes a deal with Flagler County Hospital, Florida Hospital, Flagler rather. And the deal is we'll pay you $700 a month per person in this zip code, and your job is to keep them healthy. We're going to pay you $700 a month. Whether they all come and see you 10 times a day or whether none of them ever come to see you, that's what we're going to pay you. So mm-hmm. Now the hospital's motivation is totally different. Now they're looking at, let's find out who's at most risk of coming to the hospital and find out a way to keep them out of the hospital. How can we design clinics that will help people identify their symptoms and know what to do about it and not go to the emergency room? How can we not do all these expensive tests that we really don't need to do? Because we're not going to get any more money if we do more tests. In other words, our revenue is going to be fixed, and our cost is variable. As a businessman, you know what kind of a model that is. You got to control the cost.
And, you know, that's a very good point. And what Florida Hospital and the whole Adventist Health System is doing is developing a community cares model where we have – actually, we bring in students who can monitor a person that, for example, comes in and they're not able to read. Maybe they're illiterate. Maybe they don't have the ability to follow their doctor's directions when it comes to the medication and take it in a timely way and those kinds of things. So they end up coming back over and over again. So what the community cares program is going to do is follow those people and help them, not in a clinical way, but just to make sure they're compliant so they don't come back right as often.
Yep.
Excellent.
But it also kind of sets up a judgment call from the hospital, right? Because if somebody is near death, right, they have a terminal situation. I think somebody from the hospital said, it was an insurance provider or whatever, said that like 80% of your expenses in life toward healthcare come in the last like 10% of your life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's really somewhat of a tragedy, particularly if somebody's like, okay, you know, there's no easy way out in the world today, even when you know it's there and the family has accepted it, the person has accepted the fact, and they don't want any more tests. You know, they don't want to, they know what it is. We don't need to keep doing all this. And I'd rather have, a good 6 months of life rather than a horrible 1 year of life kind of a thing.
Right on. This is why hospice is so important. This is a wonderful thing that Bill's heading up, raising money for that. People in hospice actually live longer and live better than the alternative. And the alternative borders on torture, you know, constantly sticking needles in them, and they end up in the intensive care unit, which is just not a good place to be. And it's torture for the families as well. So,
but financially draining. I mean, here's like, you know, all yeah. right, well, if you want, you know, I wanted to use this money to send my grandkids to college, and now it's gotten all eaten up here by medical expenses and drugs that I don't even want. So let's talk about that, Bill, with hospice. It's a tough business helping people die, but the truth of it is what about people that want to die sooner?
Well, we don't help people die. People are going to die regardless. Doesn't matter. But we try to make their life as comfortable as we can, if they're on that path. And I think, you know, the only answer to that, of course, is to go back to all of us. How long do you want to live and why? You know, my mother's approaching 93, and she asked me over and over again, how do you die? You know, she's so tired of living, but she still has a great clear mind, and her body's not that good, and she knows it, and, you know, it's just really tough. And I say, Mom, well, that'll happen in time. We can't make ourselves die. That's just something that's in God's hands. But if all of us would take the attitude, okay, if it's my time, it's my time. I'm not going to go to the doctor again. Well, then what would you do? You would die sooner, probably. You wouldn't be prolonged in this experience we call life. But who of us would do that? You know, when we get to the point where we really want to, we want to live, and we want to do everything we can to stay alive, So it's not going to be a problem that's easily solved.
No, but the incentive system, again, is the root cause here. That when we have a system that encourages more tests and more procedures, and the older you get, and you get in that, as you said, the last 10%, the number of tests ramps up even more, and there's a lot of money that flows into that equation, but it's not for the benefit of the patient. It's torture. I call it torture. Maybe it's that's too strong a word, but I went through it with my mother, my father, my wife's mother and father, and it's a horrible time.
So shouldn't there be a way? I mean, like I've said this before, I mean, we're more humane to our pets when they're at a suffering time right. in their life, and we can, you know, with tears and, you know, take them and they, you know, give them the injection right. and you just watch them beautifully, you know, go off to sleep. Mm-hmm. We can't do that for us because of the lawyers, okay? So we're going to talk about that as far as do attorneys get in the way of our life and our death? Mm-hmm. And we return. We'll talk a little bit more about that. If you just tuned in, our guest this morning, we have got Dr. John Patrick, What's the Next President to Do with Healthcare, and author of the book Health Attitude. And also we have Bill Toll with Florida Hospital Flagler and the hospice.
Hospice Care Foundation Director.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back. Moving on here, we're talking about all of us and you this morning. If you just tuned in, Dr. John Patrick is with us. He is the author of the book Health Attitude, and trying to bring it all together and giving advice to the next president of the United States. Is that fair to say?
Well, I'm trying to.
Okay.
Anybody that'll listen.
Okay, well, that's why we have you on here. And you really have it kind of divided up into five things. Okay, so the next president of the United States, whoever it is listening right now, okay? You're talking directly to them. What would you say if you had 60 seconds or maybe a little more? What would you say? How would you go at it?
Well, the number one step would be to work with Congress to eliminate...
Start off by saying, Mr. President, go ahead.
Mr. President, please work with Congress and remove the provision in the prescription drug plan legislation that prevents Medicare from negotiating the price of drugs so that we can begin to have fair prices for drugs and not subsidize the price of drugs in all the other wealthy countries of the world. That would be number one.
Okay.
And number two, I would accept...
That sounds like a pretty easy thing.
It's very easy. It should be very easy. But as we've seen in Congress, sometimes the easiest of things can't get done.
Is there anybody in Congress, our local congressmen, or are they in favor, against it? It's not even on the floor? I mean, what's the...
You know, you don't hear much substantive discussion about it. It all seems to be at the extreme. Either repeal everything or make everything in Washington bigger and better for everybody. And
so there's so many things attached to it that it's so complicated that nobody would vote for or against, so it, like...
Everything is politicized.
It's become politicized, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, these areas that I've suggested here, it's not political. I mean, the price of drugs is something that affects everybody. It's not a Republican or a Democratic thing. Both sides of the aisle have been party to a lot of these special deals that were made that are to the advantage of special interest groups and are not to our advantage.
All right. So number one, very easy. What's number two, John?
Well, work on the Accountable Care Organization, the ACO. This is a contract. It's a model for changing how hospitals and doctors get reimbursed. And it shifts the incentive to taking care of us, making us healthy, and not having an incentive that every time we do something, they get paid. That's in place. It's working for a lot of hospitals. It's saved almost $500 million already. That's a drop in the bucket, but it's a start. We should also implement tort reform so we don't have these lawsuits, in some cases that are frivolous and in some cases seem to be boundless. The state of Texas has focused on this, and they don't allow frivolous lawsuits, and they have caps of certain amounts for certain conditions. And this is something that should be done on a national basis.
How does that work? Tell me a little bit more about that. How would they identify something as a potential frivolous, and is there a penalty to the council that might file it?
Yes. Yeah. The thing that we need to move toward is basically a standard of care. So, for example, if you have a certain diagnosis, then the standard of care says that you should get the following three tests, A, B, and C. And if a doctor performs those three tests, then they've done the proper job. But there might be 30 tests that could be done. 27 of them have almost no likelihood of being a factor. Maybe a tenth of 1%, and so maybe 5%, but very, very limited. So don't allow a suit because they didn't do all 30 tests that could have been done. They did the three things that are the standard of care that all doctors in that particular, let's say, cardiologists for the heart, all the cardiologists have agreed those are the three things to do with that particular symptom. Then you don't allow the suit.
As a start. And if you need more, then you go on. But
of course, right.
But what happens oftentimes is to prevent.
Just do all 30.
Cover their backside. They do all 30.
Well, and at the same time, isn't a doctor then paid for a percent for having all those 30 tests done? So doesn't the doctor benefit by doing it anyway? So
well, under the old model, yes. But under this new model of called accountable care, no, they don't get paid for everything they do. They get paid, in the example I gave earlier, $700 a month per person in Flagler County. That's what Medicare is going to pay, period.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that takes away that incentive to do those unnecessary tests and procedures. And I know of hospitals where the CEO looks at a list. They have software now. They compare all the doctors. There might be 500 doctors that practice at that hospital. And high to low, which ones recommend the most tests and the most expensive procedures and the most drugs? And the CEO calls them in and says, I want to talk to you about why you're diagnosing or recommending this test 10 times more than any other doctor is.
I got a question for you, Bill, and maybe you don't know, maybe I'm asking the wrong guy here. But, okay, the doctors on staff at, because also going back to Ken Mattis, by the way, the town hall meeting, it wasn't a town hall meeting. It was the meeting he had at the cafeteria that morning. I kept telling him he should do a town hall meeting with this information, and we would broadcast it here for the community to really understand what the hospital is trying to do.
Well, let's work on that. That's a good idea.
But one of the things was the doctors then that are on staff at the hospital are allegiant to, they don't have an outside practice. They don't have an outside office. For the most part, doctors I found are horrible business people. I used to own a professional center, had doctors in there as tenants, and they were all horrible when it came to running their own business because that's not what they do. And I guess in college, they don't teach them too much about business administration and things. So what a relief for a lot of doctors to just come and work at the hospital. They have their own facilities there, their own office there and everything. And my question is then they can give 100% of their effort to just doing what they do and what they wanted to do. Do they get malpractice off their back? That's another thing you hear about doctors where the cost of malpractice insurance that they carry, they have to pass on to their customers. So if doctors at Florida Hospital Flagler are on staff there, do they have to have their own malpractice insurance or are they covered under some umbrella plan?
They're covered. They're covered by the employer. They're under that umbrella.
So that's a big expense off their back.
It's a huge incentive for them. A lot of doctors. Now, you know, you mentioned doctors that many of them that are not that great at business. But there are some that are really good at business. And they're, I think, probably prefer to be in practice for themselves. But there are others that it works best to be an employed physician. So we have quite a few of those. But we also have people at the doctors at the hospital that are not employed physicians. And it works out fine for, you know, whoever wants to do it that way can. It's not a matter of you have to be an employed physician to work at our hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, but the trend is clear that the doctors do not want to, for the most part, practice by themselves any longer. The insurance is part of it, but another big part of it is the data. So the hospital now collects all this data through electronic health records, and this allows them to practice what we call population health. So now the hospital looks at what's the population health that we have here in Flagler County. How many people do we have of this age, of this gender, that take this drug, that have this risk, that have seen this doctor, have seen that doctor, and they can use what we call big data and analytics. This is in the cloud. You know, this is a very sophisticated technique to identify people who have a high risk and to reach out to those people and suggest they go see a cardiologist, for example, rather than wait until they have a symptom, call 911, end up in the emergency room, get admitted, and go through all the routines.
Okay. Well, the practice of medicine is always evolving. And I learned about something called pharmacogenomics the other day, and I thought, wow, that is so cool. And yet, doctors aren't really that interested in it yet, but I think at some point they will be because then they know exactly what prescription drugs will work for which person and how much to give them.
Exactly.
All right. Well, the president is still listening. What's your third bit of advice for them, John Patrick?
Well, electronic health records are a critical part to the future of healthcare. we need to enable doctors to collaborate. So if you go to your primary care physician, then you go to a specialist, that specialist should have access to all the data that the primary care physician has accumulated with you about you over a period of time. Today, that's doesn't work very well because these systems are incompatible. So the hospital has one electronic health record, and the doctor down in Daytona has a different one. Somebody at Mayo Clinic has yet another one. Mm-hmm. There are 250 software companies that make these electronic health records, and they're incompatible. Just imagine if the internet was that way. The internet works exactly the same everywhere in the world. Credit cards work the same way everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. But healthcare information? No way. It's incompatible. So the government doesn't need to control this and should not control this, but they should implement standards, and they should get these companies together. Mr. President, get these companies together and lock the door and don't let them out until they agree on standards for the data. And this will benefit everybody and lower the cost.
And how much common sense and no controversy? Why would there, I can't see where there would be any controversy to any of the three things you've already said.
Exactly. But there are special interests under the covers of each of these. So these software companies want to say our software is better and it's better because of the following six things, and the other guys don't have those six things. And what I say to that is, competition is great. Let them compete on service, on cost, on quality, on customer support, on technology, but not compete based on incompatibility of the data.
All right. What's number four? Then we got to move on here, but go ahead.
I just touch on standards for the administration of healthcare. You know, we get these things in the mail. They call them explanation of benefits. What a joke, right? I have 4 degrees. I can't understand. I can't begin to understand and read these things. And there are no standards in the way this information is routed. This is why in Canada, for example, they have 13 different payers. People say the solution in America, we need a single payer. Well, Germany has outstanding health care. They have 200 insurance companies, but they have a standard for how the administration of that health care works, and that's why they're able to do it effectively, efficiently, and at a very low cost.
All right. Well, that sounds
Would you say that if we turn the health care industry over to Amazon.com, the problem might be fixed?
Oh, if Amazon operated like health care industry
no,
does,
no, no, no.
They'd
we
be
want
broke.
Health to operate like Amazon. Seems like it's already a model that's in place.
Once again, free enterprise. Yeah. And doing that. All right. Was there number five?
Yeah. Number five is, we need everybody in America to have some form of health care. I didn't say free, but some form of health care insurance. And, you know, we have 300 million people. India and China have over 1 billion people. If we're going to be competitive in this world, we have to have a healthy population. So we can't ignore people that aren't healthy. And, when you look at the facts, you find out that tens of thousands of people, one study suggests 50,000 people a year die because they don't have insurance. This is a horrible thing for our country. And when people say, well, we can't afford it, we can afford it. We're wasting $1.5 trillion on unnecessary tests and procedures. That would more than pay for people that don't have any money. So it's not to have government free insurance for everybody, but it's to have a program where everybody has some form of insurance.
All right. Great. I was ready to argue with you, but I can't really find an argument on that one there with any of them. It's just how to go about it and get it done.
Get it done.
All right.